Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. One sign of a return to normality. New York Times columnist Paul Krugman is doing his first in-person event since before the pandemic. It'll be at the 92nd Street Y on Sunday night. And that gives us an excuse for our latest visit by the Nobel Prize-winning economist right now. Among Paul Krugman's recent intriguing columns is one from last Thursday called What If Things Are About to Get Better? Can't wait to talk about that. Dr. Krugman, always great to have you on the show. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi there. Good to be on.
And since there is so much doom and gloom around all the time these days, let's focus right away as I bite on last week's column, what might be about to get better.
Okay. Almost everything, not everything, but almost everything that's going wrong economically right now is related to the fact that the pandemic ain't over. Is related to the to lingering effects from the previous waves of the pandemic and the fact that we had this Delta wave, which really knocked everybody back for a loop. If the pandemic is receding, and it does look as if it is, and if vaccination gets more comprehensive, which with the spread of vaccine mandates is probably going to happen, then a lot of things will start to improve. Not just the fewer people will be dying, but a lot of the economic scene will get a lot better too. A lot of the things that we're seeing, the supply shortages and all of that, are actually directly or indirectly the result of the pandemic, and will get a lot less severe once normal life can be resumed.
Let me ask you about an aspect of the supply chain problems. President Biden just got the ports of L.A. and San Diego to start working 24/7. Why would a COVID pandemic clog up the ports?
That's an interesting story. I mean, it's God, I sound like a professor, don't I? But anyway, the point about the ports is the ports are actually not processing noticeably less stuff than in the past. You know, the unloadings are proceeding at a normal pace, pretty much. What's happened is that we've had this incredible surge of demand, which is all pandemic related. Basically, people couldn't consume services, and so they bought stuff instead. You couldn't go out to eat, so you remodeled your kitchen. You couldn't go to the gym, so you bought exercise equipment. A few months ago, demand for durable goods was running more than 30% above pre-pandemic levels. So, and a lot of those durable goods, of course, come from overseas. So what's happening in the ports is not that the port of Los Angeles has somehow ceased to be able to unload ships. What's happening is that so much stuff is, you know, people are trying to buy so much stuff that comes in through the port of LA that it can't keep up. And so if the pandemic eases and people, you know, can start going back to the restaurants, can start going back to the gym, can start just sort of returning to a normal pattern of spending, then the supply chain issues will start to fade away, although, you know, it's not going to happen overnight.
Yeah, and I saw that you you cited improving statistics in your column about maybe things are getting better on the three C's: containers, which refers to this supply chain, COVID itself, and crime, which has been secondary to COVID in so many ways, that that surge in crime that we've seen over the last year, which is now beginning to recede. And I saw your tweet today about inflation, and this would be more good news, I guess. You wrote, 3-month core inflation. Why isn't everyone calling this a win for Team Transitory? What's Team Transitory?
All right. There's an argument. And by the way, I got a lot of pushback on that, some of which was justified. The question, so inflation has been high the last, you know, this year. And there's one group of economists, which by and large I'm part of, who says, look, this is really mostly a blip. that underlying inflation has not gone up and or that hasn't gone up much, and that patience, this will recede. And then there's another, so that's team transitory, and then there's team permanent or whatever, which says that no, this is the 1970s redux. Now it's incredibly, in a way, the weeds are so deep here, I don't even want to put a toe into them. How you read the various price measures is very much a matter of, you know, what do you choose to emphasize? The headline inflation, the top number is high. Core inflation, which is the normal way that the Fed tries to cut through the noise, which is to exclude food and energy. Core inflation, after having gone high for a while, has dropped off. But then there's a big argument about whether that's really telling us the story, how much of that is that, you know, used car prices were a big factor in core inflation a couple of months ago. They aren't now, but housing rents in particular seem to be rising quite a lot, and that isn't really showing yet. And you can argue around and around. I would still say that the balance of evidence is that this is a temporary disruption. It's associated with all of these things that we've been talking about in supply chains, and that it will go away. But the main thing is that you want to ask yourself what's the right thing to do, given that we don't know, given that it could go either way. And I would still say that the risks of prematurely tightening, of raising interest rates, and turning out that was the wrong thing to do, are much higher than the risks of letting inflation run for at least another few months.
You know, there's a big social justice, economic justice question that I want to ask you about inflation too. Like, we generally root for inflation to be transitory, to be temporary. But I saw a take on TV last night from Derek Thompson of The Atlantic, and I hope I'm characterizing him accurately. But the way I understood it, he was arguing that the inflation we've been seeing might be a good thing. Why? Because the global economics that we've been pursuing for the last 30 years has been driven by low prices from cheap goods made primarily in China. But that came with declining real wages for most workers here, decline of the middle class. Now, because of the pandemic, labor refuses to work that cheap anymore. And so inflation, the result of higher wages, might be a sign of a little more economic equality creeping into the system. It made me think of your column about things getting better, because it would be yet another sign that things may be starting to get better in that way. But I'm curious if you see inflation right now in that same light.
Well, very not much of the inflation we've been seeing these past few months is about wages. So the higher prices of used cars is not doing anything good for the American worker. But we are seeing now significant rises in wages. We're seeing particularly extraordinary rates of wage increase in leisure and hospitality, pretty good wage increases across the economy as a whole. And just in general, we're seeing there seems to be a kind of you can take your job and you can take this job and shove it mood among American workers. The Times wouldn't let me use that as a headline, but but it's clearly what's happening. And that's a good thing. I mean, the workers are basically American workers have been really badly treated relative to their counterparts in other advanced countries. We're overworked. The population at large is overworked and underpaid. We have far less vacation than just about any other wealthy country. We have lower wages for ordinary workers than most other wealthy countries, and it looks as if the workers are kind of saying, you know, enough of that. I'm going to quit. I'm going to find. I hate this job. Unless you pay me more, I'm not going to do it. We were actually seeing a wave of strikes now, which is actually, you know, on a fundamental level, that's a good thing. It's saying that workers are feeling empowered. So, yeah, I don't know if about inflation being the good thing, but a workforce that feels more able to stand up for its rights, that is a good thing.
And listeners, now you have a little behind-the-scenes glimpse of New York Times headline writing. They wouldn't let Paul Krugman use the headline, take this job and show it. Now, was that because it's a copyrighted title of something or because that's shove it is too spicy for the New York Times?
Yeah, it's still the gray lady. We've gotten looser, but it's still a kind of Victorian sensibility about not using language that could be interpreted as being a little over the top. So, all right. Usually, I get it away, but they wouldn't take that one.
Before you go, you want to say anything about your first in-person event since the start of the pandemic, which also returns us to your theme of things are about to get better. I see it's Sunday night at 7:30 at the 92nd Street Y in conversation with MSNBC's Ari Melber. Why is this the moment you're going in person again?
Basically because vax rates are pretty high. New York is a place where everything is indoor events have vaccination requirements, and I've gotten my booster shot, and so I think we're at the point now where at least in high vaccination parts of the country, it's starting to become safe to go back to normal. And God knows I miss it. I mean, I've been living my life on Zoom like everybody of a certain certain class for the past 18 months, and I'm kind of sick of it. So I'm looking forward very much to being able to talk to a live audience.
And I see that's a benefit for the Y, because like WNYC and other cultural institutions, they've been hit hard by the pandemic economics. Have anything special you're going to do there Sunday night?
Nothing. To my knowledge, if there's going to be any stage theatrics, I don't think so. What I'm going to do is find out, actually, I actually haven't worn any of my suits in all this time. We're going to find out if my suits still fit.
Quick, well, you'll see if the 24-hour dry cleaning places still work. All right. Dr. Paul Krugman, New York Times columnist. He'll be in conversation at the 92nd Street Y Sunday night with MSNBC's Ari Melber. And thanks, as always, for coming on with us.
Thanks. Good to be on.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as a special treat to close out our show today, tomorrow, and Friday during the membership drive, we're delighted to have Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Tracy K. Smith with us. She's a former Poet Laureate of the United States, as some of you know, from 2017 to 2019. For the rest of the week, she'll be reading and talking about poems from a new anthology that she's edited. It's The Best American Poetry 2021, those books that come out every year. Well, Tracy K. Smith is the editor of this year's edition. And in the introduction, she writes, "The best poems of the year reached her as offerings of desperately needed hope and endurance." So with me now is Tracy K. Smith. Later in the week, we'll also hear poems from her own new collection called Such Color. Hey, Tracy, thanks so much for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And I know your term as Poet Laureate has ended. You recently joined the English department at Harvard as a professor of English and of African and African American studies. How's it been to start a new role during the pandemic?
Mm-hmm. It's been exciting. Last year was a heavy lift, and it's nice to feel like a new chapter is beginning. And this is a place that's been important to me, and it's nice to be back for a new part of, my life. But in a way, it feels like a new moment in the world is hopefully beginning.
Indeed. And so let's hear something from The Best American Poetry 2021. You want to start, I think you've agreed to start with a reading of a poem called Irony. You want to set this up for us?
Oh, yeah. This is a poem by a really wonderful poet whom, sadly, we just lost this past month, Camila Aisha Moon. A poet of, I think, huge conscience and compassion, and her work has been long committed to the sanctity of Black life in many different ways. And this is one of the last poems of hers that will be published, I think. Irony. It would be now, when you feel want is no longer your enemy, that your body and soul would kneel. Oh, it would be now. When you feel you've culled joy, seized a new zeal, that death grabs you, fingers icy. It would be now, when you feel want is no longer your enemy. When I read this poem last year, it felt like such a poem about time, mortality, and also, you know, the, as the title suggests, the awful irony between enlightenment or crossing emotional or psychic hurdles and maybe coming up against the end of one's life. During a year of so much loss, the poem spoke really powerfully to me. Of course, now it speaks in new ways as I grieve a wonderful poet and a friend. But I think the poem manages the stakes of time, of loss, of knowledge and anxiety really beautifully within the form, which, as you hear, is built on a lot of repetition and rhyme. In a way, it feels almost like the cage of existence, you know, the way that, that these wheels of form keep spinning around.
The cage of existence. And what a last line in that poem, want is no longer your enemy. And of course, it's not because you've got everything you want, which never actually happens in life.
Right.
But that deeper thought about that, that, that she expressed and that you read. Let's do one more. I suspect most of our listeners know the name Louise Erdrich for her fiction, but she's also an incredibly accomplished poet. You've chosen Stone Love as one of the best poems of 2021. You want to set this up for us?
Sure. You know, a lot of the poems in this book feel haunted or like they're visitations. And sometimes that comes through encounters with other people, things that are startling. And in a poem like this, I think it comes from a feeling of mysterious revelation. In the note at the back of the book, the poet writes about driving through a lightning storm and feeling like the sight of the heavens in turmoil began to speak to her and offer her a poem that, that I think is about time and about love. Stone Love. I spent a star age in flames, bolted to the black heavens, waiting for you. Light crept over the sill of the earth, 1,000 upon 10,000 upon 100,000 years, but no light touched me deep in depthless time. Waiting for you. Fate flung me out, hauled me here to love you as a stone loves, waiting for you. Touch me, butterfly. Like you, I have no hands. Kiss me, rain. Like you, I have no mouth. Snow, sit heavily upon me. Like you, I can only wait. Come to me, dear, unenduring little human animal. I have no voice but your voice. Sing to me. Speak. Let the clouds fly over us. I've spent a star age in flames just to hold you. I love the huge epic sweep of this poem and the way that it, you know, it brings my mind and my ear and my spirit and everything else that is reading the poem with me to, you know, a sense of, you know, the mythic scale that we think that, you know, the poets of old, you know, the oral tradition, poems that had a role, you know, that, that might be more than just literary or entertaining, poems that were sustaining and nourishing. This poem carries that kind of energy for me. And again, you know, in the context of 2020, to be bolstered by something as ageless as this poem seeks to be, and to be reminded that there's a connection between our, what she calls, unenduring little human lives and the elements and something as ageless as stone, that was consoling.
Louise Erdrich, as most of our listeners have probably never heard her before or heard her work before. And yeah, that's one. I'm going to have to go back and read that one again or re-listen to you reading it because I didn't know that. And there was so much in there. It seemed to go so many directions at the same time. Well, we're out of time for today. You're going to come back tomorrow and Friday and do more at the same time, except you want to give us just in like 15 seconds, if you can, how an anthology like this comes together. You know, we see those books in the bookstores, the best poetry, the best essays, the best this. of each year. How do you even pick it in short order here?
Well, you know, you get the assignment or the opportunity to build this thing. And so you start reading voraciously in many different directions. And I didn't want to just read the magazines and journals that I tend to turn to automatically, but I wanted to scour and get a real range of the work that was published. As I was putting together, these poems started talking to each other.
And tomorrow, some of your own work. Tracy K. Smith, thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
No, that's not the Brian Lehrer Show theme music. What you just heard was the Dominican-Italian singer Yendri performing Nena in a Tiny Desk home concert, a Latin music takeover of NPR's Tiny Desk concert series presented by the podcast Alt Latino, another NPR presentation. For Hispanic Heritage Month, they've lined up a whole host of performers from emerging talents like Venezuelan-born Miami singer-songwriter Maya to well-known bachata performer and son of the Bronx, Prince Royce. With me now to talk about the takeover of El Tiny and to listen to some more of the performances is Felix Contreras, host and co-creator of NPR's Alt Latino. Hey, Felix, thanks so much for doing this.
Hey, Brian, thanks for having me, man. It's an honor to be on your show.
An honor to have you. And listeners, we have time for a few of your calls. We can hear from you what you're listening to this Hispanic Heritage Month, 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. You want to tell us a little bit before we hear another track about what we heard in the intro? Introduce us to Yendri and her song Nena?
Sure. What we've done is take over all month from Hispanic Heritage. From the Hispanic Heritage Month is September 15th to October 15th. And what we've been able to do is work with the Tiny Desk team to do a takeover and present Latin music the whole month. So we have 10 artists from 8 different countries and cultures, and the emphasis is on youth. Some of the younger artists, some blockbusters, some A-listers. Like you mentioned, Prince Royce, son of the Bronx. I love that. But also some discoveries from Havana and M. Alfonso, different artists from different countries. So we try to put together like a 30,000-foot view of what's happening, a little bit of what's happening in Latin music today.
So let's go now to Miami and hear a little bit of the singer-songwriter Maya performing De Cifra. And Felix, I gather that was a premiere of a brand new track. Do I have that right? How cool was that?
Yes, we're very, very fortunate. And some of the artists decided to save some stuff for us for this very special series. Yeah, we're very excited about some of that stuff.
You want to talk more about that performer and that song?
You know, one of the things that we try to do with the with each presentation, you know, we have a production crew, Bobby Carter and Ana Maria Sayre, who are part of the Tiny Desk production team. And what they do is they have long conversations before the people even roll tape, before the artist roll tape on anything about what the presentation is going to look like. And we're not dictating anything, but we are taking ideas and making suggestions. And one of the suggestions is, like, how are you going to represent your culture, your background, your music visually? And in Maya's case, you know, she performed it at a Venezuelan restaurant, one of her favorite Venezuelan restaurants, but she also includes some traditional Venezuelan instruments. A Venezuelan cuatro is performed in the video at one point in the video. So there's, you know, everybody has a different take. There's a band from Colombia recorded Bogota. They're using traditional alegre drums and mixed in with their kind of electronic rock thing. You know, it's the whole idea is to be able to represent, again, visually and musically, where these folks are coming from.
And in the description of each Tiny Desk concert video in this series is a note that El Tiny, the project, will feature performers from all corners of what you call Latinidad. Are there specific overlooked corners that you're especially interested in signal boosting for this project?
Let's see. You know, I think that mainly we have Colombia, we have Argentina, Venezuela, Havana. I'm looking at my list here. Dominican Republic, as you mentioned, Prince Royce. I think mainly it's like these are countries, the countries themselves are not overlooked, but the, maybe the artists themselves. And it's a tricky thing, Brian, because like somebody like Prince Royce, you know, who's going to be popular in New York is maybe not as popular out in the Southwest with Mexican Americans, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's the idea is to, you know, spread information and enlighten people from within the Latino cultures as well as from outside of the Latino cultures about these artists. So going back to, you know, the individual artists, you know, there's a great rapper, hip-hop artist from Argentina. She slows her flow down a little bit, and there's more of a ballad or bolero-type approach to her stuff, but she's still delivering her very, very strong message, socially conscious message, feminist message within her music. And she also has a bandoneon, like the Argentine accordion that's used in tango within her electronic thing, man. And it's really a spectacular combination of the past and the present.
I want to ask you about a controversy. Nominations for the Latin Grammys were revealed this week, as I know you know, and the genre reggaeton was all but overlooked. And J Balvin, who stopped by El Tiny, said the lack of acknowledgement because of that, reggaeton acts should boycott the ceremony. Do you want to tell us about the controversy?
You know, we talked about that recently with Ari Shapiro on All Things Considered. And, you know, I think there are points on both sides. I think J Balvin has a point in that the Academy is not giving reggaeton its due, given the influence that it has in the Latin music world in terms of streams, in terms of video views. You know, all of that stuff is where the value is determined, at least financially, monetarily. And even this is a thing where even culturally, the genre is just, it just filters down all through all these other genres. We hear, if you listen closely to a lot of the artists that we're playing, there are hints of reggaeton, that little dum-ga-dum-bop beat, right? There's some of that in a lot of these performances. So that the influence is just like hip hop and around the world, it's the same thing. Some of that stuff is filtered down. So there is a strong presence, right? But culturally, musically, around the world. They're mm-hmm. locked out of some of the major categories in the Latin Grammys. So, you know, yes and no.
You yourself are a musician, Felix, a drummer, I see. Are there particular acts or artists who inspired you to play? And do you hear those influences of some of the artists that you're spotlighting?
You know, I'm of the age where Santana was probably the biggest influence, you know, back then from the very first album. And, you know, his influence is felt, it just filters down like, you know, like a piece of ice on a radiator, right? It just filters down and seeps into just about all of these different things. He opened, he and his band opened so many doors in terms of the music industry, in terms of the audience listening to things that are different and accepting things that are different. So while he may not be a direct, like, musical influence on any of these artists, any of these folks who are making music now, I think they have a lot to do. They have a lot to be grateful for the work that they did back then in terms of, you know, what they call crossover, but just influence on the music business itself.
So yeah, that's... tell people... well, I'm curious, actually, I'll follow up on that. Have you had a chance to play much yourself during the pandemic?
You know, I have a... thanks for asking, man. We have, with some former NPR employees and current NPR employees here, we have a band that we do Beatles covers with Latin rhythms, right? It's called Los Day Trippers. And initially, we didn't play anywhere because everybody was locked down. But then we were really nervous about even being outside. So, as you know, we're following very closely the reports about where things stand, and then the virus, I mean, the variant just really set us back, as well as like musicians all over. I have friends, you know, musicians in LA, New York, all over the country, all over the world. Everybody's doing the same thing. Everybody like locked down for a long time. and then gradually started getting out, and then you just follow the trends, right? So we played a lot during the summer. We get outdoors. We're playing in the fall a couple of times, and then after that, we're not going to go inside. Some places here in the D.C. area are allowing people to perform inside buildings, but we're not going to do it. We're going to hold off, and we're just going to lock down until the springtime. And I'm hearing a lot of that from a lot of musicians. I'm fortunate in that I don't make my living playing music, right? Mm-hmm. So we have that option. But some of these musicians, man, they get hit hard when you can't perform, as you know, we've been reading about and hearing about all around the world, really.
You've been name-checking artists from all kinds of genres in the context of our Hispanic Heritage Month conversation here. The Beatles, Weather Report, Queen. Does everything influence everything?
You know, the short answer is yes, right? And I'll use that Queen example, Carlos Alfonso, who's from Havana, had lived in Havana his whole life. That's one of the things when I interviewed him for the show. It's like, what are your main influences? And I expected some, you know, some traditional Afro-Cubans. It's like, oh, his first thing out of his mouth was Brian was Queen, you know, Freddie Mercury and all those vocals, the way they stack the vocals. So I think that that's one of the things, if I can do anything with the show, with all Latino, it's just to enlighten folks. It's like, you know, we listen to everything all over, everybody, Latin America, here in the United States. We just listen to everything. There's a great new record out right now where Elvis Costello reimagined, he retook his this year's Model album from 78. Same tracks, but all Spanish language artists, right? And they had like younger artists, older artists, Juanes, all of these different people who were in love with Elvis Costello's record from here in the United States all through Latin America. It's a reminder that, you know, musicians don't really hold two genres, like the record industry or the radio industry, the commercial radio industry. They have to keep, they need to know where to put the records in the record stores, right? But musicians all over the world, all over Latin America, Spain, anywhere in the Spanish-speaking world, and really all over the world, they ignore genres, man, especially these young kids now, Brian. My God, it's like it's anything is possible. And it's just, I get my mind blown musically at least once a month. And that is no lie.
That is a good
thing.
It's
crazy.
We're going to play one more track before we go. But just tell people, because I think some of our listeners right now never heard of Alt Latino, don't know about the El Tiny series for Hispanic Heritage Month, and may not even know about the ongoing NPR series, these little concert videos called Tiny Desk Concerts. So just tell people how they can hear all this stuff.
Go to npr.org/music or npr.org/tinydesk. We have a special YouTube channel for Tiny Desk. I think we've been doing it 10 years, maybe 11 years. I don't remember now, like just well over 1,000 videos of all kinds of genres, you know, everything under the sun. My job is to book the Latin artists. So I've done, you know, big names. I've done folkloric music, you know, all kinds of stuff from all over the place. It's really a source of music discovery. And warning, it is a rabbit hole, man. You start and no telling where you're going to end up or how long you're going to be there.
It's so true. And the format of the Tiny Desk Concerts is so fun and so compelling and so intimate because it really is in a small space. And I'm always amazed at how with some of these bigger bands, how many people you can fit into the Tiny Desk Concert space. How many musicians are there in the band Snarky Puppy and, you know, and on and on and on.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
All right, last thing.
One of the things we did is like these are all home concerts. These are concerts recorded from home because Bob Boylan, who's you know helps run the basically runs the Tiny Desk, and it was his idea, along with Stephen Thompson.
Yeah.
You know, what
from
do we do
pandemic.
During the lockdown?
Right.
Right.
Felix Contreras
so
is hosting, co-creator of NPR's Alt Latino. It's been great to have you. Just set us up. Give us a 15-second setup here for this last track we're going to go out on by Bronx-born Dominican-American Prince Royce. The genre is bachata, right?
Yeah, definite bachata. And you got to go see the video because in his presentation of culture, Dominican culture, He recorded it sitting in a Dominican hair salon, man. They nailed the performance. The ambiance is so perfect for this thing, man. It's really a highlight of the series.
Felix, this has been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, man. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.